When we left off last time, King Charles I had just made what historians politely call a catastrophic miscalculation. He'd stormed into the House of Commons with armed soldiers to arrest five Puritan members of Parliament that he had accused of treason, only to find that the accused had been tipped off and were nowhere to be found. The dramatic royal show of force turned into one of the most embarrassing moments in English constitutional history. Faced with an angry city and the realization that he'd just violated centuries of parliamentary privilege on live broadcast, well, the 17th century version anyway, Charles packed up his family and quietly left London. He would never return as a free man. With the king gone, Parliament's leader, John Pym, stepped into the vacuum with the quiet confidence of a man who had been waiting for exactly this moment. He was, in effect, a king without a crown, and without the awkward hereditary baggage that often came with one. Parliament moved quickly. The bishops, who sat in the House of Lords, generally royalists in their sympathies, were voted out. The surprising part was that a good number of the lords themselves agreed to the measure. Having cleared that obstacle, Parliament then began purging anyone insufficiently enthusiastic about the Puritan reform agenda. The body was becoming more radical by the month. Parliament then ordered its own militia to be raised. For Charles, this was the final insult. The power to make war was a royal prerogative, and Parliament was simply taking it. He gathered his loyal forces and prepared to respond. After years of tension, grievous religious differences, constitutional argument, and mutual suspicion, England only had finally arrived at the one destination that everyone had been trying to avoid: civil war. The two armies that formed reflected the deep social fractures of that age. Charles drew his support from the traditional nobility and the landed gentry, men whose wealth and status and worldview were bound up with the monarchy. They supplied the cavalry, which had really always been the aristocracy's military speciality. Owning a war horse was something of a rich man's hobby. Parliament, by contrast, drew from those who had suffered most under Charles's heavy-handed rule: the lower classes, the emerging merchant middle class, and a handful of disaffected nobles who had never quite found favor at court. Parliament controlled the navy and thus controlled trade, which turned out to matter enormously for a nation that was dependent on commerce, as Britain at that time was. Now, in the early stages, the fighting consisted mostly of minor skirmishes while both sides tried to, well, build their forces and find allies. Charles looked to the Irish Catholics, which was politically awkward, even by the standards of that day. Parliament looked north, to the Scots. Now, to win Scottish support, Parliament, it had to offer something in return, and what the Scots wanted was Presbyterianism. English Puritans weren't naturally Presbyterians. They generally preferred a congregational model, where each local church government would govern itself. But the bishops of the Church of England were even worse, as far as they were concerned. A Presbyterian arrangement at least eliminated the despised episcopacy. It made reasonable biblical sense, and here's a bonus the Finance Committee appreciated: confiscating the bishop's property would fund the war without raising new taxes. Pragmatism and theology arrived at the same destination. Parliament convened a remarkable body of theologians to formalize that arrangement. It was the Westminster Assembly. It included 121 ministers, 30 laymen, and 8 Scottish representatives. Now, the Scottish contingent made up only 5% of the participants, but they brought with them the most powerful army in Great Britain, which has always been, well, a compelling argument in any theological debate. Their influence was decisive. The assembly produced the Westminster Confession of the Faith, which became and remains one of the foundational documents of Calvinist orthodoxy worldwide. Though some members favored congregationalism and a few even leaned towards the episcopacy, the Presbyterian model won the day. In 1644, Parliament formally joined the Scots in the Solemn League and Covenant, committing England to Presbyterianism. The following year, Archbishop of Canterbury William Laud, who'd spent years making life miserable for the Puritans, was executed on Parliament's order. History often has a grim sense of irony. Now, among the men that Parliament was producing at this time, one of them stood out: Oliver Cromwell. He came from respectable means. He was a descendant of Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's formidable chief minister. He's the subject of Hilary Mantel's brilliant Wolf Hall trilogy. It was later adapted into a television series. Until the Civil War, Oliver had been simply another unremarkable member of the House of Commons. A few years earlier, he had undergone a Puritan conversion that had genuinely transformed him, and he had become an avid student of Scripture. Convinced that every decision, whether personal or political, ought to be grounded in the will of God as revealed in Scripture. When armed conflict became inevitable, Cromwell went home and raised a cavalry corps. He understood that the king's greatest advantage was his horsemen, and that Parliament needed to answer that in kind. What he built became famous as his Ironside troopers would ride into battle singing psalms, absolutely certain that they were doing the Lord's work. Now, it may sound strange to modern ears, but that certainty bred a ferocity and a discipline that more cynical armies just couldn't match. The attitude spread throughout Parliament's forces. At the Battle of Naseby in 1645, the Parliamentary army crushed the Royalists decisively. When they captured the king's baggage train afterwards, they found correspondence proving that Charles had been secretly inviting foreign Catholic troops to invade England. It was not a great look for the monarchy. Now, Charles tried negotiating with the Scots, hoping to play all sides against each other. The Scots took him prisoner and sold him to Parliament. With the war effectively won, Parliament enacted a series of Puritan reforms, including establishing Sunday as a day for worship rather than for horse racing and cockfights and what they called frivolous pastimes. The English people had decidedly mixed feelings about all of those reforms. The Puritan coalition, which had held together under the pressure of war, now began fracturing along the fault lines that had, well, really always been there. Parliament supported a Presbyterian national church. The army, where the independents and congregationalists held sway, feared a Presbyterian establishment would become just as oppressive as the bishops had been. Tension between Parliament and the army grew to a breaking point. Then, in a development that probably should have been foreseen, the king escaped. Charles immediately began playing Parliament, the army, and the Scots against each other all at the same time, making contradictory promises to all three of them. He managed to win the Scots by promising to install Presbyterianism in England, a promise whose sincerity may be gauged by the fact that he was making opposite promises to everyone else. So the Scots invaded, the Puritan army defeated them, recaptured Charles, and lost patience entirely. 45 members of Parliament were arrested in what became known as Pride's Purge. It was named for Colonel Thomas Pride, who personally oversaw the removal. What was left, perhaps about 100 members out of several hundred, was mockingly called the Rump Parliament. It was called that because it had a certain resemblance to a body from which all the respectable parts had been removed. The Rump Parliament put Charles I on trial for high treason, the novel and alarming charge that a king could be held accountable by his own subjects. Charles refused to enter a plea, arguing that his judges had no legal standing over him. He had a point as a matter of precedent. Oh, but the precedent was about to change. The 14 lords who showed up for the House of Lords refused to participate. The Commons pressed. On January 30th of 1649, Charles I was beheaded outside the banqueting hall in Whitehall, the very building where he had hosted marquises and celebrated royal grandeur. Now, at this point, you may be asking, hey, is this a church history series or just a history series? It's a fair question. So far, this episode's been more about the English civics than the English church. And that's rather the point. You see, the Reformation had embedded itself so deeply in the political fabric of the British Isles that you genuinely couldn't separate the two. When Puritanism moved, England moved, for better and sometimes for considerably, well, worse. With Charles gone, England dissolved into faction. Scotland quickly proclaimed Charles's son, Charles II, as their king. In the resulting chaos, Cromwell stepped in with decisive authority of a man who had, well, run out of patience with everyone else's incompetence. He crushed a rebellion in Ireland with a ruthlessness that left, well, a stain on his legacy that the Irish have never forgotten. He defeated the Royalists in Scotland. When Charles II raised a force and marched south, Cromwell shattered his army at the Battle of Worcester in 1651. Charles barely escaped, famously hiding in an oak tree to avoid capture and eventually making his way to the continent. Now, back in London, Cromwell found himself with a rump parliament that was moving to perpetuate its own power indefinitely. Cromwell walked in, he looked around the chamber, and he told the members, "I think you've been sitting here long enough, it's time to go." When a member of parliament picked up the parliamentary mace, was the symbol of authority for the commons, Cromwell reportedly said, "Take that bauble," meaning, you know, leave with that. Well, and the members left. Seemingly against his own instincts and stated principles, Oliver Cromwell had become the master of England. He tried to restore representative government, but every parliament that he convened either refused to cooperate or threatened to undo everything that he'd built. Eventually, he accepted the title Lord Protector and simply governed, in practice, if not in name, as a military dictator. His policies were more tolerant than many expected from a man of such strong convictions. He made room for Presbyterians and Baptists and even some who favored the episcopacy, as long as they were broadly Protestant. He readmitted Jews to England after nearly 400 years of exclusion. That's a remarkable act for that era. He reformed the legal system, promoted education, and founded what became the first modern postal service. But on the cultural front, Cromwell's Puritan reform program gave his rule a peculiar kind of grimness. Laws were passed regulating the Lord's Day, banning horse races, shutting the theaters, prohibiting a range of amusements that the average non-Puritan Englishman had grown rather fond of. The Maypoles came down, Christmas celebrations, which Puritans regarded as pagan in origin and excessive in practice, were discouraged. The English people, never particularly fond of being told what to do with their leisure time, they began to sour on the whole Puritan arrangement. Cromwell was offered the crown, but he refused it, genuinely believing that England should be a republic and not wanting to become the very thing that he'd overthrown. He died in 1658, and in a moment of bewildering political contradiction, he named his son Richard as his successor. Richard Cromwell, nicknamed Tumbledown Dick by his detractors, he was a decent man, entirely unsuited to the office. He resigned after only 8 months, and the experiment was over. Parliament then recalled Charles II from the continent in 1660. England kind of exhaled. The theaters reopened, the Maypoles went back up, Charles II, who was charming but cynical and thoroughly chastened by a decade of exile, he initially sought a moderate religious settlement that could accommodate Presbyterians within the Church of England. But the new parliament was not in a moderate mood. They insisted on a full restoration of episcopacy. The Book of Common Prayer was reinstated, a series of laws collectively known as the Clarendon Code barred nonconformists from worship, from holding public office, and from living within 5 miles of a town where they had previously ministered. Well, obviously the laws didn't work. The movement that had been born in the previous decades, Baptists, Quakers, Presbyterians, and others, they simply continued meeting, but now outside the law. They were fined, they were imprisoned, they were harassed, and occasionally worse. But they persisted, and their persistence eventually produced the Toleration Act of 1689, which finally granted legal recognition to most Protestant dissenters. If England's restoration was bad for dissenters, Scotland's was catastrophic. The reinstallation of episcopal authority in a country that had fought, bled, and covenanted for Presbyterianism produced a reaction of violent intensity. Archbishop James Sharp of St. Andrews, who had been a Presbyterian himself before switching sides at the restoration, which the Scots found, well, unforgivable, he was dragged from his coach and murdered in 1679 in front of his daughter. This act of fury triggered English military intervention in support of the Scottish royalists. The period that followed, known in Scottish memory as the Killing Time, it saw hundreds of Covenanters executed or dying in harsh conditions for attending illegal outdoor worship services. They were called conventicles. Scotland at this time drowned in blood. On his deathbed in 1685, Charles II converted to Roman Catholicism, confirming what many had long suspected, that his religion, like much else about him, had been a matter of convenience throughout his reign. His brother and successor, James II, made no such pretense. He was openly, aggressively Catholic and moved quickly to install Catholics in positions of power and reverse decades of Protestant settlement. In England, he tried to build a coalition of support among Protestant dissenters by offering them religious toleration, the idea being that toleration for Catholics required toleration for everyone. But the Protestant dissenters, deeply suspicious of Rome, preferred no toleration at all to the risk of a Catholic restoration. In Scotland, James VII went further, imposing Catholics in key positions and prescribing death for those attending authorized worship. So after 3 years of James's reign, the English, they'd seen enough. A group of leading nobles and bishops, in a conspiracy that was about as secret as conspiracies can get, invited William of Orange, the Protestant Dutch ruler and husband of James's own daughter, Mary, to invade England and take the crown. Well, William landed in November of 1688 with a substantial army. James's support evaporated almost immediately. Faced with defections even from his own family and his military, he fled to France. The whole operation was remarkably bloodless compared to what had come before, which is why it earned the name the Glorious Revolution. William and Mary were crowned jointly the following year. Their religious settlement was genuinely tolerant by the standards of that era. In England, the Toleration Act of 1689 granted legal protection to Protestants who accepted the basic doctrines of the 39 Articles and swore loyalty to the crown. In Scotland, the settlement went further. Presbyterianism became the official religion of the Scottish Church, with the Westminster Confession as its doctrinal standard, a position that it technically holds to this day in the Church of Scotland. But the Puritans didn't win everything that they had fought for. They didn't create the godly republic that they had originally envisioned. Their cultural reforms largely failed to stick, and the Church of England rolled back most of their institutional gains. But their influence on the shape of the English-speaking world proved far deeper than any single political outcome could measure. Two literary figures, above all, carried the Puritan vision forward into the culture. John Bunyan, who spent years in prison for preaching without a license and used the time to write, gave the world The Pilgrim's Progress, an allegory of the Christian life that became one of the most widely read books in the English language for centuries, second only to the Bible in many English-speaking homes. John Milton, whose Paradise Lost retold the story of creation and the fall with such, breathtaking scope and grandeur that it shaped how generations of English-speaking readers understood and visualized the biblical narrative. Both men, writing from the margins of a society that had turned against the movement they represented, produced works that outlasted every Puritan law code and every Lord Protector. And across the Atlantic, the Puritan experiment that had largely failed in England, it was finding its second act. The settlers of New England, many of whom had left precisely to build the godly society that seemed impossible at home, were planting ideas about conscience, covenant, and accountable government that would bear fruit in 1776. But that, as they say, is another story.